edition of the Top 100 Project welcomes a brand new sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, fans of classic movies. Thanks for pressing play on the Top 100 Project, the weekly podcast that reviews the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American movies. Spoilers are ahead, so get out now if you don't know what happens in this violent, blood-unsoaked picture. I'm Ryan Ellis with my star uncrossed lover, my wife Bev.
That's me.
We never had stars crossed.
No, we never had to sing songs to fall in love.
That's
and
true.
Go behind our friends' backs.
And have our families kill each other.
No, yeah, nobody died.
Fight about stupid crap.
It's kind of boring when you think about it.
Yeah, we're pretty dull. Speaking of dull, our dog Fox is padding around here somewhere too. So if you hear him, then you'll know that he is contributing to West Side Story. And that is our film this week. So here's the coming attraction trivia for West Side Story. This is in fact a Romeo and Juliet story, but only one of the star-crossed lovers dies. What's the next AFI movie that doesn't cop out and does kill both of the romantic leads?
Is it Titanic?
No, you're way off.
Ah, I thought she dies at the very end.
I guess we should say spoiler alert on many of the films we might talk about in the next couple of seconds here.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, who doesn't know about Titanic? One of the biggest hits of all time. No, it's in the 60s. 1967, a strong year. Four films.
Oh, my gosh. Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde. The next one where romantic lovers die. And further spoiler alerts, we have three movies in a row in 1969, very shortly after Bonnie and Clyde, where all of the male leads end up dead. Three in a row. And if they're lovers, it's not on screen. Maybe hidden. Okay, the Top 100 Project's 61st movie in 1961, appropriately, is West Side Story. And it was 41st on AFI's 1998 Top 100, between Hitchcock thrillers North by Northwest and Rear Window. Then took a hit of 10 points and finished 51st in 2007 between Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, and Taxi Driver. West Side Story had a New York premiere on October 18, 1961, and was unfurled by United Artists over the next few months. Audiences were in heaven, and they made this picture a gigantic success. Bev will describe that film for you now with a skinny.
Natalie Wood is Maria, and Richard Boehmer is Tony, family members of rival New York gangs in this musical version of Romeo and Juliet. Maria and Tony just want to be together, but will their warring families let them? It's a Romeo and Juliet, so take a guess.
Or in a nutshell, bored kids take time out from dancing schedule to commit a few murders.
Yes, the film really combines all the directionless whining of Rebel Without a Cause with 14 years of jazz tap training.
Well, that was the first time this movie was referenced, I think, by us in the podcast, where you do the whole, wait, you're red jet.
When he jumps into the bushes and, like, points his toes and puts his arms. It's pretty hard to take you seriously, sir.
Well, we watched this movie when we were on vacation. Oh, very quick little aside before we get into West Side Story any further. Also on vacation, we watched Ace in the Hole and The 7 Year Itch, both Billy Wilder films that I said we were going to watch at one point.
Yeah.
Quickly, what'd you think of the two of them?
Oh, they're both really great. 7 Year Itch is, I mean, it's kind of forgettable ultimately, but so charming.
We truly laughed a lot, too.
Yeah, it was like really funny. It's such a fun movie to watch. So delightful. And Ace in the Hole, I haven't stopped thinking about it ever since. It was it got under my skin. You told me at the time that it was too cynical and too dark for audiences at the time.
Yep.
But it's a shame that people haven't revisited it.
Oh, they have.
Critics have. Oh, okay.
Let's not forget, one of the great things about movies, as long as they're preserved, is that home video can resurrect anything.
Yeah.
And Ace in the Hole is a good example.
We've already had lots of examples of that even in the project.
Sure.
Vertigo is a great example. Citizen Kane is another one.
Movies that weren't successful at first. And Ace in the Hole was considered a flat-out bomb. Worse than those two, I think. Mm-hmm. There's a story about how when Wilder made Stalag 17 next, and that was successful, very successful, in fact, the studio said, well, we're going to take the profits from this film and take them back from what you didn't make for Ace in the Hole, which is incredibly crappy, wrong, and everything else, I guess, isn't it? But then he made a movie that's lasted. And Kirk Douglas, the only AFI film we talked about on Spartacus last week.
Yeah, yeah.
And now here you go, where he's in a movie that probably wasn't going to make it, but I think it got nominated for the second list. And if you've never heard of Ace in the Hole, you should definitely check it out. It is cynical, but it holds up well.
Yeah.
And it's pretty well done. Kirk Douglas does this Kirk Douglas thing, a little over the top at times.
I can't say I'm the world's biggest Kirk Douglas fan after watching a few of his movies. We've watched three this year because we watched that as well as The Bad and the Beautiful. He's not my fave, but it was a great movie. I really liked it. I liked both of them a lot. So different. Billy Wilder had a good range.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to talk about Wilder anymore on the project, at least not officially. We're probably going to refer to him plenty of other times, just indirectly like this, because unfortunately he's already done. But he had four AFI films, and maybe could have at least that one more with Ace in the Hole. 7 Year Itch was fine, but that's not an AFI caliber film. All right, well, this one was, in the eyes of the AFI, obviously, that is West Side Story, one of the biggest hits of all time. Let me read a few more numbers about this before we get into the discussion. 68th on Box Office Mojo, $400,000 ahead of the first Harry Potter flick. Now, of course, that's adjusted for inflation. That's when you, basically, you're counting tickets. You're saying how many people actually saw this movie. The only bigger hit in 1961 was 101 Dalmatians, which is one of the hugest hits of all time as well. When you talk about response from people, 94% of current critics, or at least Rotten Tomatoes critics, I should say, 94% of them and 85% of audiences, a pretty big split. There you go. That's a lot of people that like this movie. What did you think?
The film does all the things that people who hate musicals hate about musicals. It takes itself too seriously. It has characters breaking to song and dance out of nowhere. Any social commentary is pandering and gutless. The suspension of disbelief required to buy gangs of street toughs pleeing their way through a fight is just too much. That being said, I loved this movie. I don't think I could defend it, but I loved it. The songs are beautiful, and the dancing, as ridiculous as it is amazing. So, like, kinetic and unique, bursting with energy. I kind of never wanted it to end.
And it's 2.5 hours.
That's saying a lot. And it's 2.5 hours. I got chills every time a song started. Now, for context, part of the reason that I love this film and I love the music so much is because when I was in high school, I went to a performing arts high school, and we put on a production of West Side Story, which, for people who are not in the know, anybody who loves musical theater at all is obsessed with this play. People lost their minds when they found out there were more people auditioned for West Side Story than anything else that we ever did. People went crazy. There was practically a party when they announced that they were doing West Side Story. There's an episode of Glee where they agreed to do West Side, and all the kids reacted the same, and it looks so familiar to me. Musical people love this musical. The songs are really iconic. The characters are really iconic. There's lots of opportunities for fun dances. America and I Feel Pretty are just such great, fun songs to dance to. Yeah. And then I guess, I don't know, the Jets. I really can't defend that. But I worked on the play in high school. I was just crewed the play because I'm like not a good enough singer and dancer to be in a musical. But my job was to run the MIDI during rehearsal. So I heard every song over and over and over again. I knew every word for like many years while we were watching the movie.
Explains why you were singing along.
I knew like all the words to all the songs. And it just brings back these wonderful memories of this great time I had in high school working on this play. So I have a lot of reasons to have super positive associations. But I loved the dancing so much.
Okay, well, we've had several musicals on the podcast so far. Swing Time you didn't like. We both trashed that one.
We've
had good ones, though, like Sing in the Rain, Wizard of Oz. We're going to have Sound of Music. We're going to have My Fair Lady Cabaret. And then there's others, too. But the two I would definitely have to compare to anything that's a hit. A film that wasn't a big hit, actually, Sing in the Rain, which you know I like a lot. We talked about that plenty.
Yeah.
I know I said this on these podcasts. I will repeat myself now. But I buy the singing and dancing almost always in those films. Sing in the Rain in particular, because they're performers. Usually it makes sense in the context, and they have dream sequences. Wizard of Oz, the whole main plot of that movie is a fantasy, a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But right from the beginning, this movie does that.
Street toughs.
And I don't buy it. And then the funny thing is, I hadn't seen this movie in, I think, 16 years. I've mocked it plenty over the years, including an introductory podcast where I talked about it, one of the movies I didn't think was worthy of this list, saying that as somebody who hasn't seen it in so long. Now seeing it again and seeing the context of all these movies, I'm not going to say that I would have put it on the top 100. But I understand why people like it so much, I guess. Except that they also have songs that take you back out. I was starting to get more into it. And I'm starting to think, when you're singing along with some of these songs, and let's face it, America, I Feel Pretty, Somewhere, Tonight is it called?
Tonight, yeah.
All those songs are pretty well known in the lexicon of musicals.
Yeah.
They're up there with some of the great songs of all time. So it's hard to hate those. They're definitely well-played songs. And most of them do make basic sense. I can buy most of them where they fit in and how they work and all that stuff. The solos and the big numbers. They actually go to a dance. At last, an excuse to dance. Which does lead to that great one between Maria and Tony when they first see each other. And they have that kind of gauzy effect. I like that.
Yeah, I like the filmic techniques. But actually, the Tony-Maria relationship is where it kept losing me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's get back to that in a minute. But Tony's Something's Coming number, I thought it was called something else. But I looked up on the IMDb, and I guess it's called Something's Coming, where he sings by himself after we've just met him. It's a time waster. It just establishes his character, I guess. It's completely superfluous in an already long movie. The cool number, towards the end. The movie is gaining steam. We've had the scene. Hey, we already said we're going to spoil this movie. Everyone knows Romeo and Juliet. So Mercutio and Tybalt in this movie are Bernardo and Riff.
Yeah.
One member for each gang, not deliberately killed so much. Although Tony does kill Bernardo.
In a
pretty
rage,
much deliberately.
He murders Bernardo.
It's 98% deliberate.
Yes.
But the other murder is way more accidental. Although then again, why are you holding your knife out there and so shocked that you stab somebody? But then after that sequence, which is a very effective sequence for the most part, it's a little bit silly at times, including Bernardo wearing a vest. Very stylish as he comes to the
street
fight.
Oh my gosh, they're like the most well-dressed.
He looked great in that vest too, that dark purple vest.
They're very polite, first of all. They never curse. And their hair is always combed, and their shirts are always tucked in. It's so silly.
Well, the not cursing thing, apparently the play, and this is a very famous musical play as well. It's based on the 1957 play. And in the 1957 Broadway musical version, it was very risque with body lines and lyrics. I'm not going to say them now because our rule is we're not going to swear if the movies don't swear. But they did in the play. And of course, Hollywood wouldn't let them in 1961.
It's always funny to be reminded how in the 50s and 60s, artists, writers, performers could get away with so much more in the theater than they could in movies.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's the opposite.
Yeah, you're supposed to be so proper on the stage and yet they really weren't. Yeah. But getting back to my point about the story itself, every time the movie gains momentum, they have that cool number, which is just absolutely absurd, and it ruins all the momentum of that scene that's so famous from Romeo and Juliet. I am fortune's fool, which is that line that Romeo says. It's not in this movie, and okay, fine. I don't think there's any real significant lines they're taken from this very famous play that so many people could probably quote by memory. But in that moment, Romeo, Tony in this movie, makes that accidental killing happen. You feel for Tony, although ironically, if he didn't show up to that knife fight, well, then again, if it wasn't supposed to be a fight, it was supposed to be a fist fight, but if he didn't show up...
Somebody would have gotten beat up, but that probably would have been the worst thing that would have happened.
Would the gangs have honored that as being, well, okay, that's it, we're finally done our war.
But it was Tony stepping in that, like, messed it all up.
Right. Yeah, so he indirectly caused what happened with the two guys getting killed. Now, by the way, the Jets earlier in the film talk about, and I think it's during the, when you're a Jet song. Before or during it, Riff, who's played by Russ Tamblyn, and he was in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, another musical. And he and also Richard Boehmer were in the Twin Peaks TV series.
They were?
Yeah. One of them played the psychiatrist, the other one Ben Horn.
Yeah, Russ Tamblyn was the psychiatrist. And
Boehmer was Ben Horn? That's right. Boehmer was Ben Horn. And Tamblyn also was in Drive and Django Unchained in recent years, so some zeitgeisty kind of films. But he says something, and here's a trivia question for you. What is the previous gang that they must have run off, beat, whatever they did? And we fought somebody else. What was the name of that gang?
Oh, gosh. You know, I read it. It's like something silly. The Unicorns or something.
Hawks.
The Hawks. That's what it is.
So I finally finished my point now. And that is, I love the Romeo and Juliet story. And this one plays it pretty much straight through, except they don't kill Juliet.
Yeah, they sissy out.
Yeah, definitely a sissy out. But the story itself, you didn't like the Maria and Tony thing. A lot of people didn't. Not many people, I should say, talk that much about Natalie Wood, and certainly not about Richard Boehmer all that much. But I think they're pretty committed. They don't get to play the sassy parts. They've got to carry the story. And I think they do that pretty well. They do sell instant love about as well as people have ever done it in Romeo and Juliet.
I know. That's actually a film thing or book thing. I always hate when movies and books rely on that love at first sight thing, that two people could actually be that committed to each other just after laying eyes on each other across a room. I find it very hard to root for a couple to get together that way.
Because that's lust at first sight. That's not love at first sight.
And it's just unrealistic. Nobody actually behaves that way. People, like you say, they may lust after someone that quickly, but they're not going to like turn against their whole family and their whole way of life because of somebody they saw across a crowded room.
Yeah, you're right. You do that for somebody you knew for a long time, I suppose, but not somebody you don't even know yet.
You could fall in love with someone. We already talked about Titanic today. At least they got to know each other. He won her over. He charmed her. There was something much more than a physical attraction between them. They had a chemistry that you witnessed that had to do with more than just their looks. Whereas Tony Maria just see each other and stop, and the whole world goes away, and it's just, she's so hot. He's so hot. Right. He's not that hot, for the record. That's the other thing that bothered me. I find her beautiful, and she looks so breathtaking in that dress and everything. But he's just kind of dull looking, and he's so dull, his character altogether. I did not like him as Tony.
You know who could have played him?
Yeah.
Many people, but Elvis Presley tops this
list.
And Colonel Tom Parker turned it down.
That's right.
He turned down a lot of parts that Elvis could have had, and this is one of the ones that, I mean, Elvis had an okay film career, and we all know how great he was at his actual job, but he could have had this role. What a shame he didn't.
Another neat contender would have been Dennis Hopper. He was up for the role.
Who already had an established career, actually. I was reading about how he auditioned. The other guys I read that auditions who were pretty big names either then or
Warren
all time.
Beatty.
Warren Beatty was new at that point. He actually made a movie the same year, 1961, with Natalie Wood.
Yeah, that's right.
Splendor in the Grass.
Yeah.
Which was either his very first movie or his second, because he made two movies in 61. I should have checked to see which one came out
first.
But
this is such a cool story about how she got the part, because they were dating. Mm-hmm. They met on the set of Splendor in the Grass. Mm-hmm. Then he was auditioning for the role of Tony, and she had been helping him with all of his lines, and agreed to go to the audition with him.
Really?
And help him read his lines at the audition. And when he was there, they noticed her, but not him. Like, she wasn't there to audition for the part. Right. That's how they discovered her. Yeah.
How about that? I didn't read that part on my
yeah.
little research there. Didn't get the part, though, obviously. Anthony Perkins, who was coming off of Psycho.
I think he would have made a great Tony.
But as we said on Psycho, he was already typecast. They wouldn't have bought him as an honest, normal, romantic lead, I guess. That's and the last name I want to mention about this, Burt Reynolds, who was by no means established, but was
crazy.
A dreamboat. And we also, on vacation, saw a Burt Reynolds movie.
That's right.
Best Little Horrors in Texas.
That's right.
When he was still at the peak of his drawing power.
Yeah.
Charming
yeah.
and funny, and he even has a song in that movie. He even sings with Dolly Parton.
Yeah, that's right.
As a duet with her. Bamer, we said, also was in Twin Peaks with Russ Tamblyn. He's still alive, actually. I don't recall if he's still working, but he was also in The Longest Day, a movie that many other people were in. And I guess his other big credit would be in The Diary of Anne Frank. He played a major character in that, as I recall. He was also, and here's a story we got to talk about, dubbed, as was Natalie Wood. He was dubbed by a guy named Jimmy Bryant, who didn't have very many other relevant credits. But Natalie Wood's dubber, Marnie Nixon, did. Three in particular. The second one I want to mention would have been before, and that was on The King and I, where Deborah Carr, who is in
From Here to Eternity.
Right. And she was dubbed in that movie by Marnie Nixon. And the last one, and we're going to cover this one. We're not going to cover The King and I, obviously, because that was in 56, and we're way past that now. But the last one is My Fair Lady, Audrey Hepburn.
That's right.
And the interesting thing about that, we're going to talk about that extensively on that movie, but very briefly, Julie Andrews played My Fair Lady on stage, didn't get the part, would have definitely done her own singing, but Audrey Hepburn, as great as she is, and she's very good in that film, didn't. A lot of people say she didn't get nominated for the Oscar, let alone win it, because of that very fact. She was dubbed, and it was not known back then. It wasn't something that really came out, but I guess it got out.
That being said, Natalie Wood and Richard Bamer, were they nominated for Oscars?
Neither one.
No, they weren't. Mm-hmm. But Rita Moreno, who played Anita, and George Takiris, who played Bernardo, who did their own singing, and were fabulous, especially Rita Moreno.
Yeah, they steal the movie from the leads.
They
in a lot
really
of
do. I mean, the character of Anita is always just better. She's the best character in the play. She's everyone's favorite character. Mm-hmm. She's like Rizzo in Grease.
Yeah, okay, that's a fair comparison. Yeah, fair comparison.
Yeah, so she's just the most spirited, fun. She gets the best song in the play or the movie, to be sure. She gets America. She's wonderful. You're right. She steals every single.
That was the one song.
And
was
they won the Oscars. They both won supporting Oscars.
That's right.
Yeah.
It did not happen a lot in the history of the Oscars. Well, From Here to Eternity it did with Sinatra and Donna Reed. But there haven't been a lot of times where both the supporting people or both the leading people won Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Shakira was pretty much an unknown, but he had been in many movies as an uncredited dancing background player. Or I think he even sang sometimes. He certainly sings in this film. And he did a lot of movies before West Side Story, dozens as I count, and then he later did a lot of work on TV. So he's one of those guys that had this one shining moment as a film performance, but not many others. Not to discredit his work in this, because he is great. He is stylish. He wears that great purple vest.
One more, yeah.
And he had played a riff on stage. He was the opposite guy.
Yeah, they dress up a lot of white actors to play Puerto Ricans in this movie, which was slightly scandalous.
Right, I want to get to that in 1 second, but let's do Moreno first. She's already been in a movie that we covered, Singin' in the Rain. She was one of the studio people, a lackey of Gene Hagen's character in that film. And she was in The King and I and Carnal Knowledge, and she's also still working. And she's also the only of at least the major three, Natalie Wood, George Takiris, Rita Moreno, who actually was Puerto Rican. I always thought she was Italian. I was looking this up because I made a note when we were watching the movie. I said, look up to see how many Puerto Ricans were actually Puerto Ricans.
Yeah.
And she's the only one, at least of those major
three. The only one.
Takiris is from, I think, the Midwest, and Natalie Wood's from L.A.
Considering that a major theme of the movie is how immigrants are poorly treated and not given the same opportunities that born citizens of the United States are given, the fact that they then cast a bunch of white actors as Puerto Ricans, that's pretty bad.
No, Chiquira certainly fits the bill, the look. Like, as Nardo. As a
he does,
Puerto
he really
Rican.
Does, yeah.
But Richard Boehmer is more Puerto Rican than Natalie Wood is.
Really?
No, I mean, he looks more Puerto Rican.
Oh, I guess.
I mean, I guess he's supposed to be Italian, and Italians can certainly be dark-skinned.
No, he's supposed to be Polish.
Oh, but right, okay. Right about that, yeah. See, I am actually putting my own remembrances of this movie from so long ago that I always assumed it was Puerto Ricans and Italians battling it out. Because my original nutshell was something to do with immigrants. But of course, the Jets are not immigrants. Well, not directly immigrants the way the Puerto Ricans are. Now, the trivia question for you. How long does Maria say she's been in America?
Over a year?
1 month.
1 month.
She speaks the language quite well, though perhaps they speak the language very well in Puerto Rico. I'm not very well versed on the territory that is Puerto Rico. I think it's a territory. I know it's not a state.
We're Canadians.
We can do research, but we don't necessarily know these things the way we should. Well, Natalie Wood, the star of the movie. And I think she was cast more for box office appeal than for much of anything else because she doesn't sing. She doesn't really... Well, okay, she looks close enough. I don't want to harp on that too much.
She has dark hair. That's about her.
And as I
That's
said
her
to
Puerto
you,
Rican credentials.
And as I said to you during the movie, she looks better in profile than from the front. She's a very pretty woman regardless, but her profile is just perfect.
Yeah.
We've covered her before twice already. We already mentioned one of them, Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah. I love her in Rebel Without a Cause. Mm-hmm. I thought she was wonderful. This movie, I mean, she's very charming. She's very pretty. She's playing the giddy schoolgirl lover very well. But the fault also is that Maria is just kind of a boring character. But she just did nothing for me. Her voice, Marnie Nixon's voice is beautiful.
Yeah.
And did a really wonderful job with the songs. She didn't do it for me.
Well, I think you said the same thing in The Searchers, which is a small role anyway.
Yeah.
But she's almost like she's gotten worse as you've gone along.
Yes.
She became a good actress as she got older. She didn't live very long. We talked about that in Rebel Without a Cause, how she died young, fairly young at least, in a boating accident. But 3 AFI films, which is more than a lot of people we've seen lately. Kirk Douglas and Charlton Heston only had one each.
What do you think of Natalie Wood?
I thought she was fine in the movie. Like I said a few minutes ago, I think that they carry the story for me better than they do for you. Because I was buying into that. Because I do love the original Shakespeare story. And I don't really have a problem with the singing and dancing now that I've seen the movie again. And knowing what I'm going in to see. When I saw the movie the first time and didn't like it, I was a lot younger. I wasn't a movie buff the way I like to think I am now. I was trying to become one. Maybe I just didn't appreciate what this movie tries to be.
It's kind of a movie for theater buffs. Even though it's quite cinematic, they take advantage of the
medium. Well, it's cinematic,
but
there's a few things about it that aren't so cinematic. Now, one thing that is, the very opening, those helicopter shots from New York City, those are fantastic.
Beyond the helicopter shots, that whole dance sequence in the beginning, which is
establishes
enormous.
The West Side pretty well, yeah.
And it's really well shot. They really take advantage of the camera,
Kudos
the angles. It's not something you could have done on stage, what they did in that opening sequence.
But a lot of the movie does feel really contained. And part of that would be that it's, what is there, two cops in all of the West Side?
I know.
We keep seeing Simon Oakland, who was the talkie shrink at the end of Psycho, who plays Shrank, the cop who's always lecturing everybody. And his, what's his name again?
Officer Krupke.
Krupke, who's his lackey. And then at the very end, we see a few other cops. But we pretty much only ever see those two guys trying to handle all the problems in the West Side.
Yeah.
Which only seem to be these two gangs that they're handling in the first place.
I know. They're the only thing wrong with the world, according to Doc. They make the world lousy.
So I think that's part of it, is that the movie does feel contained, and that's fine, but they are in New York. New York was bustling in 1961, I'm sure, but we see it in The Apartment. I think that was probably a fairly accurate movie. Interesting little thing compared to The Apartment. The previous year's Oscar winner, this one won in 1961.
Oh, yeah. New York.
But also, if they're on the West Side of Central Park, they're not far away from Bud Baxter's apartment.
That's right.
But let's get back to Natalie Wood for a second, because that makes me think of the ending, where Tony gets shot by Chino.
Yeah.
He's been calling for him, he's drawing him out, and then, oh my God, there's Maria, and of course, he ends up dead with no blood. That's why I said earlier the unbloody movie that this really is, considering there's
a little
knife to death.
Yeah, it really
But again, 1961 censors and all that kind of stuff. Then Maria basically harangues everybody and scolds them. Kind of like, here's a spoiler alert for another movie. We spoiled so many already. The end of Red River, two characters who want to kill each other are scolded. I mean, I wish we had visuals on these podcasts sometimes so I could do this finger wagging thing right now. But that's what happens. A woman basically tells them, you two are friends. Stop this. Oh, she's right. Oh, come here, pal.
That was easy.
And considering these two gangs wanted to kill each other, and one of them just shot somebody and did kill him, what did she say? A few things? I think she sings or something. You've got to stop this stuff. Now, I guess that plays into the...
No, she points a gun. gun at their heads.
Yeah.
Like a crazed maniac. You don't know if she's going to pull the trigger or not. It's a little more than finger wagging.
But the movie
friend.
Implies that they've all hung their heads and, yeah, okay, we got to stop this. I mean, really, truly, not just right now when she's pointing a gun at us and maybe we'll shoot us.
There's also something else that makes them unite universally, which is every time the cop is around, suddenly they're all besties and they can all just like
I kind of like that element.
That they're like, yeah, we may hate each other enough to kill each other, yeah. but we hate the cops more and like, we'll like stick together.
Like tight lips Tony or Louie, whoever his name is on The Simpsons. I ain't seen nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would put a knife in this guy if I could, but the cops? Nope.
Yeah, I won't turn him into the cops.
Nope.
Hell no.
And we do see Switchblades in this movie again. In the fight, we saw them in A Rogue Without a Cause. We saw them in 12 Angry Men.
The two movies we've seen about juvenile delinquents have both starred Natalie Wood.
Do we have any more of those? I can't think of the top of my head. Most of the movies we're going to cover next little while are issues films, musicals, and giant epics. The movies will get smaller in the later 60s, in a way.
Yeah, I keep thinking of
smaller
Easy
budgets,
Rider.
Smaller casts.
Yeah, but that's not really youths.
So what about the ending? The fact that they didn't kill them both. And that's one of my favorite things about any Shakespeare play. We talked about it when the movie was over, that in the Shakespeare version of this great play, the fact that they can both see the other person dead. One isn't literally dead.
Yeah,
they think,
yeah.
He thinks she's dead. Then he kills himself. She wakes up to see. So with his dying eyes, he can see, oh my God, she is alive. And then she ends up dying for real.
Yeah.
I love that part. I think it's brilliant writing. This one doesn't go that way. What did you think of the ending?
I don't like Romeo and Juliet. So
oh, really?
The fact that they strayed from that, I don't really care one way
so
or the
So we are
other.
Making it very clear right now that I liked the parts that you didn't like.
Yeah.
And you liked the parts that I didn't like. Although I will admit that some of the songs were very good. For sure, America's a great tune. And it made sense. They're on a rooftop. They're hanging around. If you're going to watch a musical, I can buy that. I can buy it at the dance where you're supposed to dance. But the other stuff.
To me, my favorite dance sequences were, I mean, America was amazing, but other than that, the ones with the Street Kings. The beginning, I really
you
loved
do.
It.
That's the part I like the least, I think.
I know. And I like cool, and...
You did? I thought you didn't like cool.
Jet. I kind of make fun of it. It's funny you say that it slowed the whole pace of the film down, because Jerome Robbins actually moved it. It was supposed to take place earlier. Rather than post-brawl, where they're all trying to get through and maintain while the cops are looking for them. It happens earlier in the film and replace some other dance piece or something. But I think I saw all the dance sequences, all that stuff, almost separate from the plot. Because I love the song so much, I think I was just kept waiting for the next one to happen and, you know, just had to get through all this silly talky
parts. And that's exactly
what
I don't buy about musicals, is when they literally stop a story and don't make it feel somewhat organic, at least, or even mostly organic.
But I think that's just that there are some people who can't do it, right? There are some people who are just never going to like musicals.
All right, well, you just mentioned Jerome Robbins, so that is one of the directors. This was his only film ever.
Yes, for
good
reason.
And he came home. He came home the night in 1962 for the 1961 awards at the Oscars with two trophies. One was sharing with Robert Wise for Best Director. Now, the trivia question, that's happened twice in the history of the Oscars, where more than one person won the Best Director Oscar. What is the other time? What's the other film?
Was it Slumdog Millionaire?
No, No Country for Old Men.
Oh, of course.
The year before Slumdog, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. I know Slumdog, I think the last sequence was directed by someone else. Yeah, but I think the last sequence was directed by a Bollywood director, wasn't it? There was another director that came in and did the dance sequence at the end.
Oh, but Boyle got sole credit.
No,
the Coens, by the time we get to No Country, they had always been, Joel was the director, Ethan was the producer, both wrote the movies, but by that point they were sharing credit on everything.
I always think of them as one person, pretty much.
Most people probably do.
They probably think themselves as one person.
Yep. So Robbins and Wise shared credit on the film, and the reason seemed to be that Robbins was taking way too long by shooting way too many takes, and people were getting injured too because he was changing things up on this.
Well, they were hired at the same time. So Jerome Robbins, the whole play was his concept originally. Back in the 40s, he approached Bernstein and Arthur Lawrence about making a contemporary adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, and it kind of went through different iterations. At one point, it was called East Side Story.
Yeah, because wasn't it supposed to be about a Jewish kid
and an Irish girl, I think.
Okay, so a Jewish boy, Irish
but, like,
girl.
Jewish-Irish, anyways, was going to be the iteration. But then there's some other project came out around the same time, but that same conflict. When they came back around to work on it, when they were all available, somebody lived in the West End and was familiar with the Puerto Rican conflicts.
Mm.
So they decided to make the film about that and call it the West Side Story. So it was his idea to begin with. He created the Broadway play, which was a sensation. The play itself probably deserves more of the credit because it was the truly revolutionary idea. When people saw it, it just blew up Broadway. It was something that nobody was making at the time. It was really different. The jazz soundtrack, even the dancing, to us it seems so quaint and silly. But at the time, it was actually drastically different. A real departure from what people were doing at the time. It was really different.
Well, it's way more urban than stuff like Swing Time, Sing in the Rain, Wizard of Oz, the ones we've talked about so often, for sure.
Yeah, and it was gritty at the time. It seems ridiculous.
Oh, I'll give it that.
Now.
As much as I've mocked it, it's way more gritty than the movies that I've actually liked that do singing and dancing.
So when they decided to make a film of it, they hired Jerome Robbins to work on it. But since he had never made a film before, they got Wise because he was kind of like a veteran. He was the editor of Citizen. Yeah. He was kind of a Hollywood veteran and he knew how to get a film made, but then Robbins got himself fired by being too much of a perfectionist, demanding too much of the dancers.
So Wise took over.
Yeah, and was he just economical. Went way over budget. Yeah. And apparently he almost gave himself a nervous breakdown making this film.
I guess that's why he didn't direct again.
Yeah, it was too much for him.
Well, Wise, as you said, did Citizen Kane. He also will direct Sound of Music, which we're going to get to on this list not that long from now. Another gigantic blockbuster, I believe, even bigger than this one. In fact, I'm almost certain it is. And a movie that I'm surprised is not higher on the list, considering how much people love it. I know they like this movie, but Sound of Music is beloved by
people.
Where
is it? Where is it on the list?
I think it's higher than this one. I forget now, but it's not in the top 25. When you talk about the criteria for this list, awards, money, cultural impact, Sound of Music probably belongs there, whether I like it or not. And I haven't seen it in a long time. I'll say no more about it. He also directed...
I don't think he likes it.
I remember that one better than I remember this one. Put it that way. But I haven't seen either of them in so long. Wise also directed The Day the Earth Stood Still, which I love. Certainly could have had a real good chance at this list. Somebody Out There Likes Me with Paul Newman. And the first Star Trek movie. I could probably sit here for another 5 minutes and name all his movies. And I would say at least a third of them were quite good.
Nice.
He was a journeyman director, did some good stuff. He also had a bit of a method thing going on. Maybe he respected that. I don't know. He was already... Well, he wasn't an old guy at that point. He's lived a long time. I don't think he died until only recently.
Oh, wow.
He was doing commentaries on some of his movies, including The Day There Stood Still with Nicholas Meyer, who was a director of a Star Trek movie, actually. And the method thing I talked about, though, is that he wanted the Jets and the Sharks to maintain a rivalry off-screen as well as on-screen. So he was asking them to do things like prank each other and that kind of stuff. I didn't read if they actually had a big problem or if they were, I hate this guy for real, or what, if they just realized in the end we're all dancers. But, well, the actors didn't get too far into character, I guess, because in the scene where they look they're going to rape Anita, Rita Moreno, I hate to say this, but I guess it's true, she had gone through a rape when she was younger, and she started freaking out, and everyone realized this isn't part of the performance after a while, is it? So they all said, okay, stop the scene. What's wrong with Rita? And I don't know how much of what's actually in the movie is her having a bit of a freak out.
Well, apparently her delivering that line where she tells them that Maria's dead, that delivery is taking place under that strain that she's experiencing.
So maybe Wise use that with a method too and say, I know that's horrible for you. I'm sorry this came up now, but use it.
Yeah.
I never really thought of him as a method director, but he did those two
incidents. It's very effective.
She's going there to save their relationship, and she doesn't mean to, but the Jets make her ruin their relationship.
Yeah.
And it isn't her fault, I'm not saying that.
But it's very believable that she would make that turnaround from being their hero to their villain.
And them trying to rape her, and they maybe would have done it had Doc not stepped in. I hate to accuse young kids of being out to rape people, but because of what's happened between these two gangs already, I guess I can sort of believe that they would take that step.
Well, they are a street gang. They are bad kids, so they're about to do a bad thing.
Yep. So Wise also produced the movie with Walter Mirisch, was an executive producer. We're going to see him on In the Heat of the Night much later in the 60s. I mentioned four films in 1967. That's one of them. And that is a much different film than this, but also has some pretty dark subject matter with cops and whatnot involved. And the movie was written by Ernest Lehman. We talked about him already in North by Northwest. Damn good writer. I think he did a pretty good job with the screenplay. Not my favorite of all the movies he wrote because he also did Sound of Music. And probably the best one of all of these would be Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Well, he's basing it on the book. I mean, all three of these were based on the play book. Apparently, this movie and the play took a lot of criticism for the dialogue really not being all that special.
And they weren't allowed to swear.
Yeah, anything vulgar had to be taken out or...
Yeah, flat out bad language was not going to be... We knew that wouldn't be allowed to be in there. So Wise, Lehman, Robbins, Mirisch, all these people, all the actors, all the technicians, made a movie that ran in Paris for 249 weeks.
Oh,
that's about 5 years.
Yeah. That is wild.
Long. 1 year. And actually, guess back in those days, 1 year wasn't that long for a movie to run, but 5 years?
In Paris?
That's what I was reading.
Oh, Le French.
But
there
speaking,
was no accounting for
that. They love Jerry Lewis. But... Speaking of long times, the shoot lasted 7 months, which was also a long time back in those days. From August of 60 to February of 61. The movie came out, as I said, later in 1961. And it only really got done when it did because Wise took over, Robbins was gone. They maybe would still be shooting this movie if Robbins was in charge of it. Hate to slag on a guy who, as you said, may have had a breakdown.
They wouldn't have looked like high school students for much longer.
Bit of a sidebar about 1961. This is the only film on the list from that year. Here are movies that came out that year that I like. The Hustler, which is one of my favorite movies, period.
Yeah, that's a surprise that got left out.
Didn't get on the list at all. Judgment Nuremberg, not a film that I would put in my favorites, but a movie that's about something pretty important, about the prosecution of the Nazis. And then Guns of Navarone, a very excellent war film.
Let me ask you this about Judgment at Nuremberg. Do they break into song?
That's part of the problem, I guess. Burt Lancaster on the stage.
Maybe if they danced.
Burt Lancaster when he's, what do you call it, in the witness box.
And yeah. Monty Cliff. Maybe if he got a little snappy in there.
Judy Garland's in that movie.
Well,
she
could
have broke out and sang, I guess. Yeah, okay.
That's their problem. That's what they did wrong.
Of all those movies, The Hustler should have made the list anyway, but certainly compared to this.
It must have been nominated.
It was.
Yeah.
One more thing I want to say about the story and all that is the very end of the movie, when it's over, they have an unusual, for the time, long credit sequence. Yeah. Usually movies at that time would either say the end or maybe nothing, and the movie's just over. Bye, yeah. Get out of our theater.
Yeah.
Or stay and watch the next show.
Oh, yeah, that's
this
right.
This one had an end credit sequence that's longer than a lot of movies we see now.
Yeah, and it was really unusual. It's one of the first that we've seen, or it is the first that we've seen in the project, isn't it?
I would say of that length, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe they're starting to make the move in that direction.
The other thematic note I wanted to mention earlier, I remembered it just now, is that it seems appropriate that all the fights take place in cages. Some of them are supposed to have been playgrounds, but they're always in cages if you think about it. Including the end scene and, of course, the knife fight where Bernardo and Riff die.
And there's a lot you always see, the fire escapes. There's always...
Oh, how could I forget about that?
Yeah.
The most famous scene in Romeo and Juliet, apart from maybe the ending, would be...
The terrace.
The Werferata, which is the terrace. They use a fire escape in this movie. Yep. And that was a nice urban moment. That was a good idea that they had probably from the original play. I don't think that was for the movie itself. I like that part of it. That was a good idea. All right, so the tech credits. The movie, a Yeti in Technicolor. We've seen a lot of that lately. Super Panavision, 70mm giant screen. And the movie was shot by Daniel Fapp, his only AFI film. He also did one of my favorites, a very possible Not 100 Project movie, The Great Escape. And he did win the cinematography Oscar for the color. Back then, of course, they still split color and black and white. The editor, Thomas Stanford, another winner of the Oscar. He also did Jeremiah Johnson in the 70s. The Boris Levin sets, also on the Oscar. And he did Giant before this, The Sound of Music after it, and four of Scorsese flicks. He was pretty good.
Yeah.
Obviously, Scorsese was a fan. Scorsese was a closet fan of musicals. Actually, not so closet, because he did New York, New York.
Stop being ashamed of liking musicals, guys.
Talk about a fast talker, faster than me, I think. Marty Scorsese. The costumes, Irene Sharaf, a five-time Oscar winner. She did in American in Paris, Virginia Woolf, King and I. Yet again, we say that. And Cleopatra obviously did a lot of musicals. And she won an Oscar. And Saul Bass, the visual...
For the vest that Riff wears in the fight?
I guess. And the dress. You know, Maria puts on that dress and she's mocking him. And then suddenly, oh, I do like it.
I think that the movie just had momentum. That's the only
reason. Well, it's probably for the sweep, one of those kind of deals. Yeah, I got to vote for every category.
Yeah.
And Saul Bass, the visual consultant, his third AFI movie in a row.
Yeah. He was all over this period of time in Hollywood.
He did Psycho, he did Spartacus, and this. All three different kinds of movies. In fact, he's in five of our last eight because he did so many of the Hitchcock ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, of course, you've got to talk about Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim, because Leonard Bernstein, who did On the Waterfront, his only non-musical movie as a composer, and he won an Oscar as well. Stephen Sondheim did the lyrics for the movie because, of course, he'd done it from the play.
Yeah, they earned that. So, in the theatrical production, it was orchestrated for 30 musicians, but then, United Artists had to big it up and tripled that and added saxophones, trumpets, xylophones, five pianos, and Bernstein hated the changes and called them overbearing and lacking in texture and subtlety. And there have been a couple of revivals of the movie where they've brought it back with the 30-piece orchestra that the play had. I guess theater purists, I'm not sure. But yeah, that was my point. That's all I had.
Really kind of trailed off there.
Look, I didn't say it was interesting.
Life wasn't great in the recording room. You trailed off there when you were saying your piece.
I thought that was going to be more interesting than it was in the end.
Well, Stephen Sondheim is a guy that I don't think we're going to mention again. I can't think of a movie that he's involved in apart from this one. I didn't know he was involved in this one until we saw the end credits. He's a pretty well-known name in this genre, though, in this field.
Yeah, sure.
All due respect to him.
The lyrics of the play are far better than the dialogue in it.
Yeah. Well, we just talked about the awards, so let's keep on with that theme, I guess, then. 10 Oscars. It won Best Picture, Best Director for Wise and Robbins, Supporting Actor Shakira, Supporting Actress Rita Moreno, the editing, the cinematography, the sound, the sets, the costumes, and the music. The only one it didn't win for was for Lehman's adapted screenplay. And I said Robbins went home with two Oscars that night, in his only ever movie as a director. He won a special one for his, quote, brilliant achievements in the art of choreography on film.
See, it's not just me.
What? Didn't say the guy couldn't choreograph a film.
Couldn't choreograph some snapping, some pointed toe pliés in the middle of a gang fight.
Oh, I don't buy it. So, the National Film Registry 1997, for such a popular movie that took a while to get that on there in 1997. And now here is where I have to acknowledge, as I did a few minutes ago with Sound of Music, that no matter what I think, this movie fits the criteria of success at the box office, belovedness over time, impact at its time, and AFI recognition in general. It had three songs in the top 100 songs list.
Tonight.
Was 59th.
I'd like to be in America.
Was 35th. And?
Somewhere.
Was 20th. I would have had America be the highest of those three.
I can't believe Somewhere was 20th. I would replace Somewhere altogether with I Feel Pretty.
Yeah, that should be in here too.
Somewhere is not the best song in that play by a long shot. Mm-hmm, and it's certainly not the 20th best song in a musical ever. America complete. Actually, I like Tonight too.
Okay.
Gosh, I love these songs, guys. I'm not sure if I've made that point strong.
I don't think she has. Okay, the other two AFI recognitions, and these are impressive. Third on the top 100 Passions. I remember when I saw that show, and I thought it was either going to be Rocky or Say Anything, maybe in the top 10 or even top 3. And it was this. I'd forgotten about this film, but there you go, number 3. And second on the top 25 musicals, the only one that was ahead of it was Singin' in the Rain.
So it beat Sound of Music on the musicals list, but not on the top 100 list?
The first AFI list, Sound of Music was lower. Second time, it was higher.
Oh.
They almost kind of literally flip spots. I would say that's just.
So West Side Story is losing esteem in the eyes of the critics, which doesn't surprise me because it is a very dated film. It's not aging well. Mm-hmm. It definitely is guilty of that.
But yeah, second and third and then three songs. That's pretty good criteria.
Yeah, if you agree with those standings. I mean, as much as I'm defending the movie, I'm really surprised that it was 41st on the 97 list.
Okay. I don't think there's a lot of influence, by the way. We always try to talk about that. I couldn't think of a whole lot. I think the biggest ones I can come up with would be this. The success, the massive success allowed Wise to make another blockbuster musical, and that would be The Sound of Music.
Yeah, probably had a tremendous amount of influence on Broadway, which in turn will have influence
They'll
on
feed
Hollywood.
Each other, yeah.
Yeah, so we probably don't realize it because we're not really big musical theater people, but I'm sure if we knew enough about dancing, choreography, and even music, the jazz and the soundtrack, maybe we'd be more attuned to how this changed, but you would give that credit to the play, not the film. The movie itself didn't rewrite the book.
However, let me say this, though. Here's the other thing I want to say about influence. It probably allowed for My Fair Lady to be made, which was before The Sound of Music. All three of these won Best Picture, in fact, in the span of just a few years. My Fair Lady and other big musicals that got greenlit in the intervening years. Musicals had not died, but they were dying in a way after the success of Singin' in the Rain. And The Bandwagon, Gigi had won some Oscars of its own, Best Picture. In fact, it swept its eight categories in 1958. But musicals weren't as big as they'd been for so long, partly because MGM was not dead, but kind of irrelevant studio by the point of being the studio for so long. And I would say West Side Story, as a movie, probably helped allow for those other movies that got made in that style. And maybe other big budget 70mm type productions. Mm-hmm. And obviously Spartacus and the Hitchcock films of those types would have helped that part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we've already said this more than enough. So very quickly, I'm going to say at the end, I can't deny it belongs on the list based on the AFI's criteria. I wouldn't have put it there. But I liked the movie more the second time I saw it. And for those who love the movie, they're going to probably think I'm full of crap anyway.
I would say if anybody's curious about this movie, watch the first 20 minutes. If you're not feeling it, if you're rolling your eyes, turn it off.
Yeah.
But if you're enjoying it, you're going to love the rest of it. Maybe even better than that, just go on YouTube and find good quality versions of America, I Feel Pretty, Tonight. Just the songs.
One of the great things about innovations of modern technology,
YouTube,
you can find
the boring parts.
You said that about Swing Time as well.
Yeah, it's definitely true about Swing Time. Less true about West Side Story. For people who like this kind of stuff, it's awesome. For people who don't, it's the worst.
So while I wrap this up, maybe you should be humming one of the tunes in the background.
Ooh, which one? We haven't done I Feel Pretty yet, so I think that's going to be it.
Up next in the Top 100 Project is something completely different and something completely better, I think. It's Frank Sinatra and his brainwashed friends in The Manchurian Candidate. So the coming attraction trivia for The Manchurian Candidate. This is one of eight AFI movies that were remade theatrically using the exact same name, and I do mean exact name, the other seven.
All right. So for the answer to that question, please tune in next week. And if you'd like more trivia and lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, please go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. We'd love to hear what you think of West Side Story and all the other movies we cover on the project. We would love to hear from you. Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And one more time, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee.
Life could be great in Canada. Sometimes it's cold in Canada.
Tonight is quite hot in Canada. Ryan and Bev coming to you from Canada.
Cut.